Accession number 12707, Captain Frank Brewis, Reel 18.
Captain HCF Brewis, Reel 18. Had there been any change in commanding officer, Captain Brewis?
Yes, the vital one. 4th of September 1943 saw the end of Colonel Heslop's reign as CO. So that brought, at that level, our connection with the Durhams to an end. It, on a personal level, it didn't end, but from the point of view of command. If I may, I'll just read briefly the special order of the day that he issued to all ranks. I've had the proud privilege and honour of being your commanding officer for 3 years and 3 months, and today I hand over this trust and a fine body of officers and men to my successor, Lieutenant Colonel J.B. Robertson, MBE, of the Royal Tank Regiment. In doing so, I have but one request to make, and that is to ask you all to give my successor the same loyalty and support that you've given to me. You all know how much this parting means to me. Great events lie before you, and although I cannot be with you in person, I shall always follow your destiny and be with you in spirit. Thank you, and God bless you all. E.T. Heslop, Lieutenant Colonel of the Durham Light Infantry. And that was followed by the first item in the orders. Number one, command. Lieutenant Colonel J.B. Robertson, MBE, assumes command of the regiment with effect from the 4th of September, 43, Vice Lieutenant Colonel E.T. Heslop posted. What had happened was that he'd been promoted colonel and was going to command Hull District. So we duly lined him up, and towed his car out of the camp. Yeah, the second in command at that stage was a Major Malcolm Dees of Royal Tank Regiment, and he went with Daddy Heslop to Newcastle to the station, well, should I say to the station hotel, and reported back that they'd said farewell, a tearful farewell, weeping tears of pure burgundy. Colonel Robertson had come from the War Office, regular Royal Tank Regiment officer, and very shortly after he came, I took the place of Jeff Harris as adjutant. Actually, what was it, about the 20-something of 23rd or something like that, of November in 43. And he wasn't with us all that long, but in a short time that he was in command, except for those first 2 weeks, I was his adjutant all the time. We got along very well. In fact, I remember one occasion when the brigadier on a telephone chewed large lumps out of me over a leave situation. He'd done a bit of statistic gathering among the technical side of the brigade in all the regiments. And he wouldn't have it when I said that there had been sickness at the brigade workshops. Some of our fitters had been transferred to the brigade workshops to bring them up to strength. They had their own people on leave. We already had a number of fitters, the sort of normal turnover of leave personnel already away when this reinforcement of the brigade workshops happened. No, he wouldn't have it. He would stop privilege leave altogether. And this was sort of late afternoon, early evening. And shortly afterwards, I saw J.B. Robertson in the mess and said, "What's the matter with you?" I said, "Well, I've just had a brush with the, or the brigadier's just had a brush with me. He's chewed me up well and truly." "About what?" Told him. And he was out of his chair like a shot and away up the brigade to say that if there was anything the brigadier wanted to take up with the unit, he was the one to take it up and not to take it out of my hatchet. So he backed me on that sort of thing. Not that it needed to happen, you know, but it's an indication of what sort of chap he was. Maybe I should go on now to what happened very shortly after he came. And that was in October, early October, the 8th. We all moved off to South Wales. I've mentioned Linney Head there. It was a good exercise in convoy driving for B Echelon. We broke the journey at a staging camp at Wellingborough, which I think is in Shropshire, that sort of area. I cannot for the life of me remember whether the tanks went by rail or on transporters. We didn't take them all. I said the regiment, there was a skeleton staff left behind, but the boys who were going to do the business with the CDLs were the main people and the signals people. Quite obviously, there was no point in moving three squadrons of tanks and scout cars didn't really come into it. Enough tanks to be able to rotate the tank crews and see that everybody got a fair crack of the whip on the ranges where we were able to fire live ammunition. And pretty extensive. Linney Head is a pretty isolated area on the South Wales coast. But it was that much nearer the other side. So, of course, we had to adopt the same ARP practices that functioned at Penrith. In other words, the faintest whisper, the first indication of a possible air raid, usual thing, security officer on duty the whole time, and duplicated telephone connections, and the very light going up and the lights out if there was any possibility of a raid. It happened a couple of times, I think, but no raid developed not in that area. Can't think that there was anything very much in the Cardiff or Swansea area at the time, or Milford Haven away to the west of us. One thing that arises out of me, there came to hand a report, like so many garbled reports about the CDL equipment, which one of our chaps, he was the technical quartermaster sergeant, produced it at a reunion after the war. Light ray kills rabbits. We were a light ray. Even the thing about that I read in the Telegraph in about 1987, talking about the possible restoration of Broom Hall, where our brigade workshops were. During the last war, Broom Hall was used for tank training and research. This was the beginning of the development of the laser, of 13 million candlepower, and so on. Well, this garbled report that might have emanated from Linney Head may have been started by John Sidney and I. Going out and not using the CDL light, that would have been very much out of order, but using the tank spotlight to pick up rabbits to supplement the pot for the mess. And while they were sitting targets because they were dazzled by the spotlight, it wasn't the light ray that killed the rabbits, it was John Sidney and I. Probably more John Sidney because he was a better shot than I. We did troop and squadron battle practices there, and it was very useful because it was not exactly billiard smooth table terrain. There were stretches where it was possible on the move to get tanks spaced as per textbook and to get a beautiful intersection down the line. There were also places that were used specifically because they were more difficult. And there were some funny shaped triangles of darkness in that sort of area. There were grants that we're using at the time. And well, we had 3 weeks there.
And what form did the training take?
Well, it was more driving practice by day for not only the driver. The drivers didn't need a hell of a lot of practice by this time, but swapping over with the gunners or the loader wireless operators, give them a chance, and the ones who had done a smattering of wireless training, so that it was not only driving practice, but it was wireless schemes as well. Otherwise, it was another version of Penrith, but with the opportunity for the first time to bring the gun tanks into action.
These came into action with your lights?
Yeah. And of course they were firing out beyond the rear, partly on the far edge of the range towards the sea cliffs, but also out to sea. They weren't firing at specific targets out to sea, but at least they got used to handling live ammunition within the confined spaces of a turret, and how to cope with spent shell cases in quantity around their feet. And
is there a method of doing this?
Chuck them out as fast as you can once they've cooled off a little bit. But it was one side of battle practice with nobody shooting back at you.
What was your role on this training session?
Nil. I was in the office. I was assistant adjutant, and I remember a visit. I can't remember the nearest village. In fact, I think I did it more than once. I had to go at the outset to liaise with the local ARP control, and I seem to remember liaising with the local police.
What was this for? What was your...
Well, it was a restricted area, of course, to start with, as all around the coast was, but it was to put the senior police officers in the area into the picture that we were using equipment on the secret list, and while we would have our own security, we felt that they might see something strange, and they should at least know that it wasn't German parachutists landing or this, that, and the other. But as far as being directly concerned, it was the hardline troops and squadrons that the practice was for. The John Sidney and I shooting rabbits was very much a sideline.
Did you have any problems with police or local officials or local
people? Not that I recall. As I say, it It was a pretty isolated sort of area, and I don't think there was any problems really during that time.
Was this training session during Heslop's time before he left, or had he gone?
No, he'd gone in the September, and Robertson had only been there a matter of weeks when this was all laid on before, and it was 8th of October. So it was virtually just a month afterwards. Obviously, that was the date when we actually started the move, and the move took a couple of days. I said we had 3 weeks, but there was a couple of days moving down there and a couple of days moving back.
You mentioned that when Robertson came, you became his adjutant, and at the camp you said you were still assistant adjutant.
Sorry, I should. I think I said that I became his adjutant in November the 23rd. And then when we came back, one thing I should mention really at this stage, and I don't think I talked about it before, but it's to do with the technicalities of the CDL equipment. I mentioned the range and the width of beam, and I may have created the wrong impression that it was like a spotlight lighting up a slice of the horizon, but in fact, due to the parabolic mirror, it went out through that narrow slit to spread into a beam of that width at that range, 340-50 yards at 1,000 yards range, but it also spread to a depth of something like 34-35 feet. So that depending on the attitude of the tank and the type of ground it was going over, or the position of the tank in relation to the horizontal, if it was stationary, you got not only a fan of light lighting up to that distance, but you got a long depth of field. About the intersection of the beams too, which became quite apparent at Lenny Head, talking about that flat terrain where it was possible to do a textbook exercise, the distances that were lined up and so on. If they were lined up in the region of 30 yards apart, then it was something like 90 yards ahead of the tank where you got the first intersection of the beams. So to all intents and purposes, it meant in average terms the skill of the operator, the skill of the drivers came into it, the type of ground and so on, but it meant roughly that the tip of that triangle of darkness was something like 90 to 100 yards ahead of the tank. And that became very obvious when I was talking about doing a sort of textbook exercise of spacing and intersection.
Well, at this stage, were the crews becoming confident and competent with the this new weapon, and did they feel that, or were they feeling that they could put up a really good show if it was used?
Very much so, particularly after Lenny Head, one would be able to, and the gun tank's crew, because all their exercises had led up to this, when they were really hearing tank gunfire, and learning more about the intricacies of handling live ammunition within the confined space of the turret. And I think they were all absolutely cock-a-hoop coming back to Lenny Head. In fact, the resumption of training there might at times have seemed to be a bit of a letdown. And maybe there were some. In fact, I'm quite sure there would be some who felt that was a peak, and they were going back to the same old thing that they'd done before, and back to a lot of consecutive night work, squadron by squadron in turn. But it was a bellyache and not much more, I think. We should have been used to peaks and troughs by that time with all the changes we'd had. But it was having been away, coming back, having experienced all the opportunities that the Linehead Rangers afforded us, to come back to what was becoming somewhat routine training exercises. It was varied quite a bit. We had wireless schemes and jaunts around the countryside with the B echelon, linking up with bringing rations and supplies to particular points. Well, without the tanks, it was what I talked about. Toots, tactical exercises without troops. But in this case, it wasn't just blah blah blah. And Mr. Sunso, what would you do in this case? It was giving the B echelon actual practice of what they were there to do. And we could always do with wireless exercises. In spite of that, there were always, even squadron leaders, telling their troop leaders to get off the B set, which was just for intercom, and having given somebody a right rollicking, the next thing was, "Driver, halt, for God's sake, halt!" That sort of thing had to be eliminated, and the more wireless schemes, the better. And harbouring by day with the tanks in cover.
Was that done to any particular plan and training?
Depended on the ground, but basically it meant a guard troop and the rest doing whatever needed doing in the way of maintenance, refueling, and getting a bit of kip and a brew up. And more or less the same thing going into lager, as it was called, at night. But there, as well as a guard tank or troop, if the ground favoured it, then it was a bit like the Wild West and the covered wagons, with the tanks, at least whichever way they were standing, at least with their guns pointing out over for all round defence, depended. Very much, it was an ad hoc exercise. It depended very much on the ground, but it was something that needed to be practiced. I made a note of Cambrai Day, 20th of November, because instead of the DLI Inkerman Day on the 5th of November, we had. Within the unit, we had a shrinking number of Durhams, a fair sprinkling of RTR officers, the odd one or two. We had a Brazilian, an Englishman from, an Englishman from Brazil, would come to us from the 22nd Dragoons. We had the odd ex-cavalryman, but mainly RTR, so we celebrated Cambrai Day. And it was obviously somebody that Colonel Robertson knew. He was a Lieutenant Colonel Tiny Miller. It was, his initials were RM, but he was known as Tiny Miller MC. He'd fought with the Tank Corps at Cambrai in 1917. And apart from the other forms of celebrating Cambrai Day and the festivities that went with it, he gave us an insight into that first tank battle. Very interesting. Later on, we saw another VC up at, somewhere near Titchwell on the North Norfolk coast, that a subsequent CO took a handful of us to meet. And he'd won his VC for walking ahead of his tanks with a flag to guide them at the Battle of Cambrai. But back to Robertson. Tank strength was building up. By the end of 43, we had 19 Shermans and 52 Grants. January 44 into the next year, the last of 95 Matildas that he'd had, they went about that time, first, about the 10th of January, I think it was. And we'd taken another 11 Shermans. Personnel. That was the January 44 was the strongest we ever were. We had 52 officers, 12 in excess of war establishment. And I don't know why it wasn't 800. But the bit I checked on said 799 other ranks, 31 in excess of war establishment plus first line reinforcements. And that was at the peak of our strength. And then, bloke me, Colonel Robertson gets himself promoted. He went in the March. So we didn't have him very long. Although he'd been a driving force. He soon settled in, and as far as training was concerned, there was no let up, but he pushed everything along pretty smartly. The only thing, he was promoted brigadier and later went to Cairo. And I read somewhere in a book about tanks in Snowley, 1945, not long after the war, he was commanding the 4th Royal Tanks in Egypt. But one thing we had against him, he decided that this regiment, with its cadre of Durham's officers who'd passed it on to the rest, so when we had a formal parade, wherever they came from, they had to march at DLI pace. No, that didn't do him. He wasn't going to have that. Net result was, he got a drill sergeant up from Caterham, complete with pace stick, and officers had to be on parade in the forecourt of Lowther Castle, away, a mile away from the camp, 7 o'clock every morning, to learn how to march properly. And we didn't like it at all. Not the remaining Durham ones. We thought it was dreadful. And I think in not in defiance, but in disgruntlement, if there is such a word, there was a rush to put up the bugle horn in the Bury. In good time before going out for the evening off duty. Previously it had been done, and I think Ted Heslop, he never did it. He was a stickler. He would have, no doubt, loved to have done it. And I think he knew it happened, but he turned a blind eye to it. But we made this sort of ridiculous half-protest in the only way we could. We couldn't refuse to turn up on parade every morning at 7 o'clock. It went on for quite a long time. We were determined that it was going to take a hell of a long time, however much it cost us, to give in. But we did it so that on occasion he saw people going off duty, improperly dressed. And we got a dressing down on several occasions. But there was a half smile round the corners of his mouth. He knew what was behind it. He knew he was rubbing us up the wrong way. However, he's a damn good CEO during that short time that we had him. What was it?